You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a whole host of music and writings from the year 1923 became public domain on New Year's Day. We'll talk about why it's taken a while for more of these materials to become public. First, since the publication of the book Evicted by Matthew Desmond back in 2017, there's been increased awareness of the issue of evictions in Wisconsin, especially in the Milwaukee area, which served as the setting for the book. Now, two recent reports from the Wisconsin Policy Forum take a closer look at the scope of the issue, both in the Milwaukee area and around the state. They find that while eviction rates vary widely across the state, they remain the highest in southeast Wisconsin. And efforts are underway to understand why and what can be done to help people stay in their homes. Joe Pietrangelo joins us now to talk about the scope of evictions in Wisconsin and the effects they can have on families and communities. He's a senior researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Joe, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the scope of the problem. Talk about where in Wisconsin we're seeing the most evictions.
Yeah, we found that they're concentrated the most in southeast Wisconsin, as you mentioned. So Racine, Kenosha, Milwaukee counties have some of the highest eviction rates, and as well as Rock County, where Janesville and Beloit are located. And we actually find that the evictions themselves are really concentrated within those counties in certain neighborhoods.
Talk about the impact that having that kind of concentration of evictions can have, not just on the individuals and families, which we'll get into, but on the communities themselves.
Yeah, so, I mean, as far as the individuals and families, an eviction can be have really devastating effects in terms immediately in terms of housing stability. It can lead to homelessness. It can lead to job loss. It can lead to school absences because a lot of the households that are evicted are families with children. In terms of, and even long-term for those households in accessing housing, because once an eviction is on your record, that's something that landlords are able to see, and as they're screening applicants, it can be a barrier, really, to accessing housing long-term for that household. And then as far as the community-wide impacts, I mentioned that what we found is that evictions are really concentrated in certain neighborhoods. So in Milwaukee, for example, we found several neighborhoods where the eviction rate was as high as 10%, meaning 10% of all renters in that neighborhood were evicted in a given year. And so you can imagine the type of impact that can have on the stability of a neighborhood, on the schools in terms of, you know, the turnover of students and the learning that takes place in schools and so forth. So really major impacts both on individuals and entire communities.
Now, does a high eviction neighborhood necessarily match up with a high poverty neighborhood? Are they one and the same necessarily?
I can't really say that, we didn't do analysis to give like a correlation but we did look at those neighborhoods that have especially high eviction rates, those ones that had 10% or higher, and they were all high poverty neighborhoods, mostly on Milwaukee's north side, some in Racine and Kenosha and some other communities, but they do tend to be, those ones that have really high eviction rates tend to have high poverty rates.
Talking to Joe Pietrangelo from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, looking at the issue of eviction. Two recent reports there looking at the Milwaukee area and then statewide. And Joe, you, your group and community groups got together to look at solutions to evictions. A lot of times people focus on, if we're talking landlord and tenant laws, just tipping the balance of power toward landlords or toward tenants one way or the other. The groups involved in coming up with these recommendations, it looks like they were saying, no, let's look at ways to get ahead of this and try to prevent evictions before they happen. First of all, talk about that philosophy.
Yeah, so this effort really rose out of the book Evicted and the light it shed on this issue. And the city of Milwaukee brought over 30 organizations together to try to come up with solutions that were, they're really focused on the households that are sort of on the verge of an eviction, but what types of services or interventions could be made to prevent that case from going to court and becoming an eviction. that was sort of where they were coming from. We facilitated the group over a six-month period, and so they were identifying where are their gaps in services, what services are out there, but they just don't have the capacity to meet the needs. How can the services be better coordinated to really help these households? And we did include a landlord association as well. And so the solutions that they came up with were targeted both at landlords and tenants getting the information and the resources to prevent those evictions. So it wasn't only tenant focused. It was also about landlords knowing where to go when a problem arises with a tenant.
And one of the suggestions I thought was interesting was, and I guess this is happening, but maybe looking for more of it, mediation. So a tenant who is risking eviction can reach out. A landlord who is saying, hey, I might have to evict this person. I'd rather not go through the court process. What kind of mediation services are out there?
Yeah, that was one of the most promising strategies we thought we were seeing. There's a new organization in Milwaukee that started about a year ago doing tenant-landlord mediation. So it's a neutral third party that meets with the tenant and landlord and tries to work through whatever issues are happening to prevent it from ever going to court. And that is, like I said, a new service, but it's early on showing a lot of promise in terms of those landlords and tenants that are coming together are usually finding ways to avoid it going to court. And so the issue is more about directing more of those landlords and tenants to that service so that they're taking advantage of it, because there's excess capacity and people just don't know that that's out there. But it seems to be a promising strategy that could be effective elsewhere as well.
Now, there are different stories that lead to a person being at risk of eviction. One cause, you mentioned in the report, is somebody with that short-term financial roadblock. They had an emergency expense. They lost a job, found another one, but there's, you know, a couple months delay there where they can't necessarily make rent. And one recommendation, I think, was to try to find some kind of short-term financial, I guess, bridge for those situations.
Right. And you know, that is the common situation, that you have a lot of renters that are paying more than they can afford really for rent, and you know, finances are tight. And so when a situation comes up, a medical bill, a car breaks down, something like that, it can be a temporary thing, but it can cause a long-term problem. And so there are some services out there already in Milwaukee, for example, and I'm sure in other communities that provide that sort of bridge financial assistance that it's just for certain households that have steady income where it's really just a temporary situation. And the issue is that those funds are just very limited, and in many cases, like through the W-2 agencies, there are funds available, but only for families with children. So, you know, many households can't qualify for some of those services. So just expanding those pools of temporary bridge funding can be another solution.
As we wrap up, Joe, with those and your other suggestions, do you think that the tools are there and the will is out there to significantly bring down the eviction rates in a community like Milwaukee?
You know, we're hopeful the process that we have been working on is moving into another phase where they're really trying to decide. You know, we came up with several solutions as a group, and they're really trying to now set some priorities and really focus on implementing some of these ideas. So, like I said, we're really hopeful that the attention that was brought to this issue, that's not a new issue, but is now getting a lot of attention, will finally move towards seeing some improvements.
Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Joe Pietrangelo, senior researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He joined us today to talk about a recent report looking at the high rates of evictions in southeast Wisconsin and how they affect families and communities. Coming up, a huge list of copyrighted material entered the public domain with the new year. We'll talk about what people will have access to and why it's been a while since songs, art, and books have been released to the public domain. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's some big changes coming to the presidential nomination process ahead of 2020. We'll talk to a political scientist about why some states are dumping caucuses and how that could affect the next presidential race. First, if you're looking for something to read or watch in this new year and you're not satisfied with what's out there, well, you might be in luck. As of January 1st, all works first published in the United States in the year 1923 have officially entered the public domain. It's the first time in over 20 years that we've had this kind of mass expiration of copyrights in the U.S. Tens of thousands of films and musical compositions are now officially in the public domain and can be published or adapted without permission from a copyright holder. Our next guest says the release is unprecedented and could have a big impact on culture and creativity. Glenn Fleischman is a freelance reporter who writes about technology, law, and culture. He wrote about this public domain release for Smithsonian Magazine. Glenn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on.
Well, first of all, tell us what it means from something to move from the, I guess, copyright zone to the public domain zone.
Well, it's kind of a notional place, the public domain. It's not a, it's like a figure ground problem. So copyright is the ground. It's like something is affirmatively under copyright, which gives the owner of that copyright the exclusive right to exploit that material. They can prohibit people from performing a song. They can prevent a publisher from publishing a work, or they can publish or produce something themselves. The public domain is the absence of all those protections, and it only a work only enters the public domain in very particular circumstances, and one of them is just the time runs out. There's a term, and it varies at points in history as to what that term was in the United States. And we had this long interregnum, a 21-year period, between the last mass expiration of a fixed copyright term and then this year. So in the public domain, works can be exploited in any way people want. There's no owner anymore. The owner is us as the American people, and no one may prohibit your use. You can sell it, you can remix it, you can do an interpretation, you can lambaste it, whatever you want to do, or give it away for free, and that's your right.
Now, if I have this right, under the old rules, right now we'd be talking about the stuff that came out that was created in the year 1962 or something like that?
Well, oh gosh, you know, this is one of these things where I've written about this so much, and it's so complicated, but the very brief explanation is the U.S. used to have a different regime than the rest of the world, and now we're harmonized. So up until 1978, when you copyrighted a work, it was it had a term that lasted from the moment you copyrighted it, from that year, and that term was gradually extended to 95 years by the time 1998 rolled around. If you create a work in 1978 or later, it's like it had been in the rest of the world, which it's the life of the author plus originally 50 years and now plus 70 years in most places.
Okay.
So that's the big distinction.
Now, part of the delay, if I understand this correctly, has to do with Disney not wanting Mickey Mouse to become part of the public domain, right?
That's exactly it. The Steamboat Willie exception, there was a law passed in 1998. It was named for Sonny Bono, who many people know as a performer and Cher's ex-husband, but he was also a congressman, and he died in a skiing accident that year. And his wife assumed his office and then was reelected several times afterwards. And she championed a bill that Hollywood really wanted, which was eventually called the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act. And it added a 20-year period to everything that was about to expire that next year and extended that life of author from 50 to 70 years. So Steamboat Willie was originally supposed to enter the public domain in, 2004. And now it will enter in 2024, unless anything else happens in the meantime, although that seems unlikely.
Talking to Glenn Fleischman about his piece in Smithsonian Magazine on public domain. A lot of stuff went from copyrightable to now public domain, including this.
We have an old-fashioned tomato, a Long Island potato, but yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Okay. Okay, now ASCAP won't be breathing down our necks, asking us to pay the money for the playing of that song now, I guess. So if I want to create art or a commercial or whatever, I can now mine the output of 1923 and use it as I see fit. Is that right, Glenn?
Yes, although, and I want to point out that on New Year's Eve, I led a chorus of people singing that at midnight in my house, 30 people, because we wanted to celebrate the public domain. That's the nerd I am. There is actually a distinction there. A musical piece that's performed and fixed in a medium like a record or an MP3 or what have you, that still has years to go to expire. I know, it's complicated. But
I'm going to get out some spare change here for that one.
That's right. You probably already paid the license for that. But if it's a piece of a published music, so a sheet music used to be a huge deal, and it still quietly is. But when a song was recorded, what happened is the sheet music could sell in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of copies. That sheet music, the underlying composition of a piece, everything in 1923 has entered the public domain. My son loves concert band music, and he was excited that there's a piece called English Folk Suite that was written in 1923. It appears to have entered the public domain this year as well, and he could now do a new arrangement of that.
Now, there was this, you wrote about this Robert Frost poem, the famous one, you're out in the snow and you want to go one way or the other, that one. That's now in the public domain, and this was a big issue not that long ago. Tell us that story.
Oh, yeah, the Stopping by Woods in a Snowy Evening is probably one of Frost's most popular works, and it's sort of associated with JFK because it was a radio announcer started reading it and then broke down in tears during the funeral cortege of JFK after he was assassinated. And this poem was written in 1923, published in the New Republic, and then in a collection later that year, and it's remained firmly under copyright protection since. The side note is it's possible it wasn't copyrighted correctly, which is a whole other thing, but it doesn't matter now because that 95-year period expired, so we know affirmatively that it's absolutely in the public domain. But the Frost Estate and his publisher, Henry Holt and Company, which continues to publish his works, really zealously defended the copyright on that work and others. And there have been attempts by people. People wanted to produce a famous composer, Eric Whitaker, had produced a composition and released it in 1999, thinking that the work had entered the entered the public domain as it was scheduled to do that year. It had not, and the estate and publisher made him stop performing or releasing this work, which is now called Sleep, but which had been based on that poem.
Now, talk about the basic debate here between, okay, you want to protect the rights of a creator to profit from their own works and not be ripped off versus the public interest in, hey, at some point, this is just part of our culture.
That's the big debate, right? And the issue is the Constitution actually defines copyright, which is not entirely unique in the world, but it is unusual. And it says that this exclusive right should happen for limited times. And the question is, what is a limited time? What right was that supposed to grant to an author? What was it supposed to convey? And at the time that the law was first implemented after the Constitution went into effect, the longest period was about 28 years. Over centuries, that lengthened to 95 years. And one asks, who benefits at 95 years? So one sort of rubric for it was maybe it's about two generations following an author's life or a creator's life. So under that thinking, as lives got longer, maybe we did need a longer period. But I haven't been able to find anybody in this last go-round as the expiration neared. None of the companies, organizations, individuals who defended the longer term in 1998, none of them seem to have that defense now. So 95 years for these earlier works and life plus 70 years for later ones, that seems to fit into people's conception of maybe that's just long enough at last.
Now, we've got all these works coming into the public domain from 1923, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, I don't know. But it's not like the government has this register, right, the complete list of 1923 stuff that's now in the public domain. We kind of have to figure it out for ourselves.
That's exactly it. Is copyright is kind of this strange area where even in 1923, you could copyright a work simply by putting the proper notice in, which was literally putting copyright and the C symbol and the year and your name or the proper holder. Because of that, some works were registered because that established ownership and higher damages if you sued and so forth. But this is an ongoing research project because so much was published that we don't know about, and libraries have scanned this material. There's a group called the Hathi Trust that's a consortium of libraries and academic institutions that have been scanning material for years. They were ready. on January 1st, they flipped a switch and their whole 1923 collection of tens of thousands of works went from scholarly only access behind kind of a restricted wall to keep it safe for copyright protection and went into the public domain and public searching. So other institutions will follow. Google Books has a lot of material. It's unclear what their plans are. The Internet Archive has a lot of material from that period. And then there's also what's neat is there are hundreds of thousands of works people have identified that fell into the public domain over the last many decades because they were not renewed at a time when they had to be renewed. So the public domain is getting ever larger and researchers are helping us to understand exactly what's in it.
So we've had a long wait for this year's Public Domain Day, but assuming that the laws don't change again, we're going to be celebrating this every New Year's Day from now on?
Yeah, there's another 54 years of this 95-year expiration, and then we switch into the new regime of life plus 70 years. So we got a long time to go. You know, all the Depression-era work, World War II, the 1950s, there's a lot of material that will be slipping slowly in, and academics and researchers are ecstatic about it. I talked to a number of people in academic institutions who it's not that they couldn't get access to a book before, but it was often difficult to obtain the rights to criticize a poem. Many estates are very, very tight. So as long as a work remains under copyright, they won't even allow an extensive passage from a poem to be published in a book that's critical or even positive of a work. So from that standpoint, there'll be more cultural exploration in that level. But this also is just a simple remixing. Is we live in a remix culture. This material can be digitized and shared, and it's time for, you know, sort of the general public, you know, whether it's individual artists or you know, just people who have an interest in it, they can take this material and use it as what it's intended to be, as a source of inspiration for creating new culture.
Glenn, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's Glenn Fleischman, reporter who writes about technology, law, and culture. He joined us today to talk about his recent piece in the Smithsonian Magazine looking at the copyrighted material that just became public domain on New Year's Day. And look at it next New Year's Day for the 1924 material, I guess. Coming up, we'll talk to a political scientist about why some states that used caucuses in 2016 are switching to primaries ahead of 2020, and some of the other changes, the other ways that elections will be different in 2020 as compared to 2016. And we'll ask you to weigh in with your thoughts on some of those changes and just sort of generally look at the weird patchwork of the way different states nominate people for Democratic and Republican candidates for U.S. president. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer-Kent and her guest for a look at the public health problems that could be caused or made worse by climate change. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, as people gear up for 2020, there are a number of changes coming to the presidential nomination process. California bumped its primary day up to Super Tuesday in March, and last year the Democratic National Committee decided to drastically scale down the role of superdelegates. But there's another change that hasn't gotten as much attention that might have a big impact. At least four states that used a caucus system to nominate presidential candidates in 2016 will now use primaries instead. David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, what are we hearing about which states are maybe making these changes and why they're doing it?
Well, so far it's Nebraska, Idaho, Minnesota, and Colorado. And I think the main motivation is that for quite some time now, people have been concerned about how few people actually participate in many of the caucuses around the country. So they really are pretty undemocratic in terms of just the few number of people who actually vote in a caucus. So, for example, in some of the lowest turnout states, Maine had about 6% turnout, so 64,000 people out of more than a million people actually participated in their caucuses, 5.5% in Kansas, 6% in Alaska, and under 5% in Hawaii. And so when you have, you know, around 5% of the voters in your state actually, you know, saying who the nominee should be for your party for president, that's really not a very representative process. Then when you put on top of it the other burdens placed on voters by caucuses in terms of the actual process where you have to go and often, you know, sit through a two-hour meeting before you can vote, and then something that maybe, you know, people who've never been in a caucus state may not even be aware of, it's not even a private vote. You vote publicly when you're in a caucus. You're in a large public space, usually like a high school gymnasium or something, and you're actually casting your vote in public because you go stand in a corner and caucus with the people who are supporting that candidate. And so all of your neighbors and all of the people in the room can see who you're voting for. And so that is another thing that just makes a lot of people pretty uncomfortable about the caucus process. And so for those reasons, many states now are moving away from the caucuses and going with the more common primary selection process like we have in Wisconsin.
Now, do we know if a caucus versus a primary brings a different kind of voter into an election?
Yeah, it does, because the greater costs of participating make it so it's usually the more intense and the more involved and sometimes the more ideologically extreme voters who participate in the caucuses. So, for example, in the last round of caucuses and primaries, Bernie Sanders actually won 12 of the 18 caucuses, but he only won 11 of the 39 primary states. And so Bernie Sanders supporters, I think, were more intense, more ideologically extreme than Hillary Clinton supporters. And he ended up doing, quite well, winning 2/3 of the caucus states, but not so well in the primary states, where Clinton won a large majority of those. And so I think you do tend to see those more motivated voters who are the ones participating, because it is harder to participate than just simply going and casting your ballot in a primary.
Now, we have this kind of patchwork. We've got some states with caucuses, some states with primaries like we have in Wisconsin, where you can just show up as and register and vote in whichever party you want. We have other states, famously New York, where you have to be registered with the party months in advance.
Right.
Why do we have this patchwork of picking our Democratic and Republican presidential candidates?
Well, right. It's a really good point, Rob, that we really do have at least, probably 20, 25 different ways of selecting our delegates out of the 50 states. It's just an incredible patchwork across the states. And the reason that we have all of these variations is because the Constitution leaves the time, manner, and place regulation of elections up to the states. And so this is something that's dictated by our national Constitution, that states get to decide the actual process of how elections will be conducted. It's not a national something that the National Congress can do.
Talking to David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison, about the primary process, some states moving from caucus to primary leading up to the 2020 elections. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see when it comes to primaries or caucuses in the 2020 election? Do you think it makes a difference? And I'd love to hear in particular from our listeners over in Iowa who maybe have experienced a caucus firsthand. Can you tell us what that's like for those of us who've never been in a caucus state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. David, did the caucus system have kind of a rise and fall? Did it used to be even bigger than it is now?
Well, it's been fairly stable at somewhere around a dozen to up to 18 or so. It's been bouncing around between that level for the last 40, 50 years or so. And it was really the big change happened after 1972, where the McGovern-Fraser reforms were passed by the Democratic Party that kind of opened up the delegate selection process. And so a lot of states moved in the direction of primaries at that point. But since then, it's been a fairly even mix. About 3/4 of the states are the primary states, and about a quarter are the caucus states. It's been fairly steady around that mix.
Now, a weird thing in American politics is we have the Constitution, as you mentioned. I'm pretty sure the Constitution doesn't say anything about political parties. And I've seen at least some historians, I can't think of a name right now, talk about the rise of parties as kind of a second constitution of American politics. And it gets weird when the party politics intersect with the original Constitution. Have we just kind of kludged a lot of this stuff together?
Well, right. You know, absolutely, the founders didn't anticipate political parties at all. I mean, they talked about parties as factions, because you certainly had the factions at the time of the founding of the Federalists, the Anti-Federalists, but you didn't have organized parties the way that you have now, especially in presidential politics. That's something they really didn't anticipate. And so the Electoral College itself had to be amended because of the way that they selected the president and vice president. The Electoral College didn't work once you threw political parties in, because you had the idea of the team ticket of the president and vice president was not anticipated by the founders at all. And so this was, you know, just a major problem that had to be resolved through a constitutional amendment. So you're absolutely right that the whole idea of partisan politics, and then this process we go through of how we, you know, nominate our candidates within the parties before the general election, is something that was not intended by the founders. And that's why we have this, you know, crazy quilt of all the different state regulations and rules that we have today, is because that's not something that was part of the original game plan.
Right. Under the original system, we'd have President Donald Trump and Vice President Hillary Clinton right now, right?
Well, absolutely. That's right. The top vote getter was president. The second vote getter would be vice president.
That'd be a fun cabinet meeting to sit in, huh?
That would be good.
Now, talking about the role of the nominating process, there's kind of a philosophical difference here in some ways. Is it that, okay, members of the party, participants in the party, should be involved in putting their candidate on a ballot, in which case maybe that caucus system sounds a little better? Or is it, no, this is a chance for the public to weigh in on who the candidate's going to be, then they weigh in again on the road, so that open primary makes a little more sense?
Well, right. I think the direction that most states are going is the latter, that this really should be a way for the public to weigh in and to have an open primary where it's, you know, it's the people getting to decide who the nominee should be for their party. But, you know, given that, you know, the political parties still are in charge of dictating the rules, you still do get the states that have, say, the closed primaries you mentioned, like in New York and a handful of other states, where you have to be a registered member of that party to participate in the primary, versus an open primary state like we have here in Wisconsin, where you don't have to be a registered Democrat or Republican to participate, you know, in the primary election. And then the caucus would be the highest level of that, you know, trying to keep it, you know, closed to the party members, although you can have both open and closed caucuses as well. It's like you have open and closed primaries. So like I said, there are so many variations in how these elections are set up.
Now, some other news out there. South Carolina Republicans are considering not having a primary, and they're the first Southern primary usually, not having a primary at all to make a smoother path for their incumbent president. This has been done before for Ronald Reagan, I think, and George W. Bush, I think I read. Is this something we see very often, a party saying, yeah, we'll just skip it this year?
It's not very common, but you're right. It has happened before, especially, you know, in obviously in the party where you have an incumbent president and you want to try to minimize any potential infighting you could have within the party. So we don't have any, you know, prominent candidate yet who has announced they'd be running against Donald Trump to challenge him for the nomination in 2020. But someone like, you know, John Kasich is being mentioned, and there are others as well who could potentially emerge as a challenger to Donald Trump. So one thing that sometimes state parties will do is try to head that off by just saying, oh, yeah, we'll just sit this one out.
We're talking to David Cannon, political science professor at UW-Madison, with us to talk about the caucus system in American presidential politics versus primaries. At least four states are switching. They had caucuses in 2016. They're doing primaries next time around. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a preference? Do you like the way we do the primary election here in Wisconsin? What do you think of caucuses? Have you ever participated in one? Maybe you're listening in Iowa right now. Love to hear from you. How do you think changes will affect the primaries for president? What do you think of the idea of Democrats getting rid of super delegates, or at least downplaying their role? I'm not sure exactly how that all shook out. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how we nominate our candidates for president. At least four states are getting rid of their caucuses and moving to primaries instead. David Cannon is with us. He's a political scientist from UW-Madison. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you fall on the caucus versus primary debate? How do you think states should do this? Should we all do it the same? I'm not sure what it would take to make that happen, but maybe. And have you voted in a caucus yourself? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. David is with us in Prairie du Chien. David, hi.
Hi, thank you. I used to live in Iowa. I attended many caucuses. I was actually a congressional candidate a number of years ago in Iowa. But with respect to the idea of a caucus, one of the weaknesses of a caucus, if I might quickly note, is that in any given precinct, it depends on the number of, in this instance, Democrats who would show up, for example. So if 20 Democrats showed up in a precinct, each candidate wouldn't even be counted as having any support if they didn't reach the 10% threshold at the first round of gathering as to who favors whom. So if there were 100 people there, if you had 9 people for candidate X, it would be reported out later that that candidate had...
I think we lost you, David. Yep, I think we lost David, but thanks a lot for that call. And, yeah, that's another wrinkle in the caucus system, David,
right.
That threshold rule.
It is, and it actually, I'm glad David raised that point, because it's another very odd thing about the caucus, how it works, is that once the candidate doesn't reach that threshold, let's say that, take as example of the 9 people who voted for someone on that first round, but they don't hit that 10% threshold, they actually get a chance then to vote again on the next round. And I've never attended a caucus myself, but I've talked to a lot of people who have, and they say it's almost like a rugby scrum at that point, where the supporters for the other candidates come over and say, come on, support us, and they're like, you know, pulling on their arms, trying to get them to come over to their corner. And so it is this, like, open, contested process of trying to attract the votes then to the candidates who are still remaining who did hit that 10% threshold. And so that process then of having it not be a private vote is something that does make a lot of people uncomfortable, because we normally think of our voting as something that's a very private act. Like, you don't want to have everyone know who you voted for, but a caucus is entirely open and public.
All right, thanks for that call. Now, David, we've got a phone line packed with people who have lived or live in Iowa, so I'm going to go get through a few of them now, and then we'll come back to you. We'll go to Eric with us now in Middleton. Eric, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I've lived on both sides of the river several times. I actually grew up in Iowa and grew up going to caucuses when I was just a little kid, and I guess that points to what I perceive as one of the big advantages of the caucuses. It's a family event. It's very participatory. People do talk to each other and try to convince each other of the other candidates. I go there not ready to vote. I go there sometimes willing to listen to other people who have looked at the issues and looked at the candidates. It's a event of democracy, not just a final go into a booth and on your own make your vote. There's another piece to it that, don't forget, this is the caucus is a party building event, and resolutions come out of that same caucus event. That's where decisions are made about what does the party stand for. And during my times in Wisconsin, I'm back in Wisconsin now, I've never figured out how that happened. It seems like the parties come down to the candidates, at least from the perception as a voter. It's just candidates here, candidates there. Their party practically doesn't exist. You don't even have to declare a party.
All right, let's go to, thank you for that call, Eric. Interesting insight into that. Marty, now on the other side of that river in Dubuque. Marty, hi. Marty, are you there? Oh, that's Marty gone. I think Jeff is with us now in Green Bay. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, just to reiterate the previous caller's comment, I participated in 3 caucuses as a bachelor's and master's student at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. And I loved how you could help establish the platform. I was very active in the mid-'80s in getting something in the Democratic platform to get government to divest from South Africa when they were practicing apartheid, and that was a very exciting thing for me. And I wish we had that opportunity in Wisconsin to shape the platform of our parties a little more.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jeff. We'll go now to Tom in Waukon, Iowa. Tom, hi.
Hi.
What do you think about caucuses?
I love them. Came from Minnesota, got down to Iowa.
it forces the candidates for governor or for president even to come to a small local place. I met Mrs. Obama in the library in Waukon. And I met the former governor of Wisconsin in a bar in Waukon. It is democracy, and it says that, you know, people are important. I love it.
Tom, thanks a lot. All right, thanks to all our callers. All right, David, we've had a hard sell here for caucuses. People have participated in them, love them. It's participation. It makes the candidates actually come out and talk to people.
Well, yeah, but Iowa, we have to remember, is distinctive in terms of their place in the primary selection process, the candidate selection process. They're first. And so the fact that Iowa is the first caucus and then New Hampshire is the first primary, Iowa gets a huge amount of attention that these other caucus states don't get. So if you're in Hawaii or Nebraska or Colorado, you're not getting that same kind of attention from every other candidate who comes to Iowa for months and months and months before the caucus. And so Iowa is really quite distinctive in that regard. Now, on the other hand, Iowa is similar to other caucus states in the points that Eric and Marty and some of the others raised about how you do have the opportunity to help shape the party platform. That's true. That's a huge advantage in terms of Democratic participation to have that kind of broader participation at that level. But it's also then a disincentive to the more casual voter, the one that just wants to go in and vote and, you know, not have to sit through a two-hour party meeting. And that's why you get these really low participation rates in so many states of 5-6% of voters, you know, bothering to turn out and participate in a caucus. So it's great for the people who are the party activists and the ones who want to be involved. It does give them a easier vehicle for getting involved and participating. But that same advantage for, like, the folks who are calling in is a huge obstacle to people who just want to have their voice heard in terms of who they're supporting for the presidential nominee in their party.
Now, one of our Iowans who called said, hey, in your non-caucus states, people aren't involved in the parties. What even are the parties if people don't have to register to vote either way? Is there something to that?
Well, and we do have our state party conventions in Wisconsin, and most other, you know, primary states will have those, where people who do want to get involved can participate in their political parties, you know, both at the local level then at the state level. So we do have similar mechanisms. It's just that they don't get as much attention because they're not the vehicle for selecting the nominee for their party. And so those institutions exist, but, yeah, they're much more in the background, not as prominent as they would be in a caucus state.
Now, when it comes to changes, getting back to the big picture, David, changes in how parties nominate their presidents, are they always fighting the last campaign in some ways, figuring out what went wrong or what people didn't like in the last one, changing it until somebody figures out how to exploit the new rules, then they change it again?
Well, right. I think that is a good insight. I think that's exactly what is happening in some of the changes this time around. Like, for example, you know, downplaying the role of superdelegates you mentioned before. That's something that the Sanders supporters were really upset that Hillary Clinton had such a huge majority of the superdelegates. So one thing that the Democratic Party did this time around for 2020 is to really downplay that role of the superdelegates by not allowing them to vote on the first ballot at all. So it's just going to be the pledged delegates from the primaries and caucuses who will be determining who the nominee will be, not the superdelegates. The only way the superdelegates would come into play would be if you had a deadlock convention. And so that's a pretty big concession to the Sanders supporters, and indeed any kind of outsider candidate who's not the pick of the insiders, because those superdelegates, those are the true party insiders. They're the elected party officials, the state party leaders, and they're the ones that were, you know, overwhelmingly supporting Hillary Clinton. And so that's a pretty big change to say we're going to take away their power on the first ballot now.
We'll leave it there for now, David, but I'm sure we'll talk to you a time or two before 2020 rolls around.
Absolutely.
That's David Cannon, political science professor from UW-Madison, with us to talk about why a number of states that use the caucus system in the 2016 primaries are moving to actual primaries ahead of 2020. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, President Trump says the U.S. will pull troops out of Syria. His own defense secretary resigned in part as a result, but our guest says the president is making the right call. Sometimes when you have a day off, you might feel like you wasted your opportunity. A time management expert gives us advice on making the most of a day off and still allowing some chill time along the way. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, the partial federal government shutdown is still going on. Kate and her guests look at the impact of the shutdown on federal workers and public services around the country. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. Then we'll discuss what Governor Evers had to say in his inauguration address this afternoon and look ahead at the top issues facing divided government in Wisconsin. Stick around. There's more to come. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.